Hello, and welcome to this installment of the Future Grind podcast. I'm your host, Ryan O'Shea, and today I'll be speaking with David Pearce, the British philosopher best known for his 1995 manifesto, The Hedonistic Imperative. Pearce argues that we should work towards the abolition of suffering in all sentient life. This sounds great, but when we explore the details of how this might be possible, including genetic modification of humans, population-level gene drive technology, and the elimination of predator species, things can get pretty controversial. We explore these and other light and fun topics, including antinatalism, existential risk, animal uplift, Nozick's experience machine, and more. As always, show notes and links are available at futuregrind.org. We're on iTunes, Stitcher, and wherever podcasts are found. A video version of this episode is posted on Facebook and YouTube. Make sure to subscribe on all of these platforms. Leave a review, and you can also like, comment, and share to spread the word. If you'd like to keep this podcast running, you can donate at futuregrind.org/support, or you can purchase some of our newly released products at futuregrind.org/store. Because of you, this is Future Grind. All right, and now we're here with David. David, thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much, Ryan.
So what is your background, and what led you to philosophy and the topics that you focus on?
Background? Well, I'm a third-generation vegetarian vegan with kind of pacifist, vegetarian religious parents and grandparents. Otherwise, I suppose, relatively normal. I was an introspective child. I used to rock in the dark, thinking about the nature of life, reality, thought, and the problem of suffering. And of course, yes, many, many people throughout the ages have thought about suffering and how to get rid of it. But we're lucky enough to be living in an era in which one can, at least in principle, see how biotechnology can be used to reprogram the biosphere, to phase out the biology of suffering throughout the living world, and just possibly create a civilization based on gradients of superintelligent bliss. Now, this didn't come to me in some blinding revelation or moment of enlightenment in my teens or anything. In fact, I think one breakthrough, at least insight for me, was actually so-called wireheading, reading about how intracranial self-stimulation shows no tolerance, and being of a rather depressive disposition, the idea that it was possible just to have nothing but bliss, or as we would now say, the anticipation of bliss, because wireheading isn't really pure bliss, that came as a revelation to me. Now, the only people who find the idea of perpetual intracranial self-stimulation attractive tend to be people who are pretty depressive, and the vision I would have of the future of life in the universe is life based entirely on information sensitive gradients of bliss. But yeah, it was just some pop sci text, and Olds and Milner, they're no longer called the pleasure centers, but yeah, that was an example of the kind of thing I used to think about in my teens.
And in 1995, you outlined a lot of your thoughts on these topics when you wrote and published The Hedonistic Imperative, through which you argue that we should work towards the abolition of suffering in all sentient life. How would you describe this hedonistic imperative, and why do you feel that it exists?
Yes, well, if I had called it what I would like to have called it, which is the moral imperative to use biotechnology to phase out suffering, yes, it probably wouldn't have resonated. So yeah, I needed essentially a snappy title with a nod to Kant. It's not completely false, but nonetheless, hedonism tends to connote to many people something amoral, shallow, and one-dimensional. But yeah, in essence, that suffering only exists because it helped our genes leave more copies of themselves than the ancestral environment. There is a deep philosophical sense in which we don't understand why consciousness or suffering exists at all. But set aside this for the moment. There doesn't seem to be any need for us to retain the nasty, raw feels of either mental or physical pain. And yes, in the hedonistic imperative, I outlined how it should be possible to recalibrate the hedonic treadmill, kind of ratchet up our hedonic range. And this would be true not just in humans, but also non-human animals. Before one can start doing really ambitious things like reprogramming the biosphere, there are various obvious urgent things we need to do first, which is shut down, outlaw factory farms and slaughterhouses, which are probably the greatest source of severe and readily avoidable suffering in the world today. But looking further ahead, the hedonistic imperative is a kind of a blueprint or manifesto. Snappily, you could call it Buddhism plus biotechnology. I'm personally a secular scientific rationalist, so more likely to say Bentham and biotechnology. Even that isn't strictly correct insofar as I'm ethically speaking a negative utilitarian, which sounds rather depressing if morally serious, but nothing prevents one, if one is a negative utilitarian, urging the creation of a biology based entirely on gradients of bliss, indeed gradients of super intelligent bliss.
I'm definitely going to want to explore a lot of the things you mentioned there in more detail, such as the practicalities of how we can go about accomplishing these goals. But right now, you also introduced the concept of the abolitionist project, which would be the project through which the hedonistic imperative would be largely achieved. But are there other differences between these terms, or are they roughly interchangeable?
Strictly, they are different in that if one is either a Buddhist or a believer in suffering-focused ethics or negative utilitarian, there's an overriding moral urgency to getting rid of all forms of suffering and ultimately all forms of experience below hedonic zero, and no distinctively moral obligation to go beyond it. But in practice, we can do a lot better than that, and rather counterintuitively, one aspect of being a negative utilitarian is one wants to abolish even the slightest hint of disappointment. And many people would be extremely unhappy at the thought that they wouldn't be able to flourish for as long as possible to enjoy the good things in life. And I'm all in favor of that. I'm all in favor of abolishing disappointment, boredom, and various nasty states like that. And so, yes, as well as talking about the deeply unpleasant stuff, the nature of pain, suffering and depression, it's possible to look beyond and explore just how wonderful life could be. I won't claim that I think that, as I said, that building a civilization based on gradients of superhuman bliss is morally urgent in the way that the abolitionist project is. But nonetheless, for technical reasons, I actually think it's quite likely, in fact, I don't know how to put a precise figure on this, that it is, whether one calls it a prophecy or a prediction. But yeah, that is my belief, that not merely are we going to get rid of suffering, but we're going to create a world based on gradients of bliss.
Before we get too far into this, I think it's important to define some terms here. Many of us frequently use words such as bliss or suffering, but these concepts are fairly hard to define in any objective, agreed-upon way. So when you use the word bliss, what are you referring to?
To some extent, it is a primitive term, and that someone who really is chronically depressed can perhaps not really imagine what it's like to be happy, let alone blissful, and would perhaps define these terms as the kind of absence of suffering. But on a purely intuitive level, if you're a neurotypical person, think of your first love or a peak experience, or if you have dabbled with various euphorian drugs, or shall we say, the pleasures of the flesh. But One of the reasons I particularly stress the notion of gradients of bliss, information-sensitive gradients of bliss, is essentially the hedonistic imperative is not calling for anyone to embrace my distinctive conception of utopia. The idea is that by ratcheting up the hedonic treadmill, I mean, you know, just imagine tomorrow morning you just wake up in an exceptionally good mood. You still got your values and preferences intact, but your hedonic set point is higher. And essentially, would like everyone to have the opportunity to have a much higher hedonic set point, no involuntary suffering. To some extent, I'm afraid I've waffled at you, but I'm afraid, to someone who literally has never experienced life above hedonic zero, which mercifully there are few people, though sadly they do exist, it won't mean much. But most people who have experienced some degree of pleasure and pain in their in life will know what I'm talking about when I say bliss. I mean, but here's, okay, let's be concrete. Just imagine your own peak experience. It may be extremely personal, or it may be much more typical, but nonetheless, yeah, the hedonic tone associated with whatever your peak experience is.
So a similar question for the word suffering. Are you using this as a catch-all term for things like sadness and misery or pain, or are you seeing suffering as distinctly different from perhaps some of these other negative emotion terms?
Yeah, I mean, it's complicated. Sometimes one just wants to talk about the pleasure-pain axis, suffering and happiness, and sometimes one wants to be much more variegated. And natural language is not precise. At what point does mere pain, let's say, of a headache become outright suffering? It's conventional, though not arbitrary. And ethically, clearly, the most urgent obligation is to get rid of the worst forms of unpleasant experience, both physical and mental. And this can be done via genetic engineering, biotechnology. But in principle, at any rate, it should be possible to phase out all experience below hedonic zero, i.e. even the faintest tint of sadness or disappointment or a pinprick of distress. Now that's much harder, or at least harder to do in a highly functional way, and much further in the future. But in that, I think the notion of above and below hedonic zero is relatively well defined, because Sidgwick's natural watershed, hedonic zero, experience that is neither pleasant nor unpleasant, that's relatively well defined. I mean, I sometimes, this is a spurious position, but if experience today takes place within the range of minus 10 to 0 to plus 10, where minus 10 is horrific pain, agony, despair, 0 is neutral, and plus 10 is your most wonderful peak experience, I would essentially see that a long-term future in ratcheting up hedonic range so we can anticipate a future civilization of, let's say, plus 70 to a plus 100 if you want high hedonic contrast, or plus 90 to plus 100 if you want lesser hedonic contrast. This is all very sweeping. One could start getting down into some of the neurological details that are being teased out. When I wrote The Hedonistic Imperative back in 1995, the human genome hadn't been decoded, but we're racing ahead now. But I think, essentially all I've really aimed to do is just set out a kind of blueprint with enough technical detail to show it's possible without nurturing any illusions that any plans or blueprints that I draw up are going to be dusted down at some future date. I mean, the science will very rapidly date.
So we can philosophize forever about whether it would be good or not to actually eliminate suffering, but an important question is, if we were to determine that it's a good idea, how would we go about accomplishing it? And you touched upon this a bit in the initial answer about wire heading and such. But if we as a society agreed to undertake the abolitionist project tomorrow, how could we go about accomplishing its goal in humans?
Well, I think Perhaps the easiest way to start would be offering universal access to pre-implantation genetic screening and diagnosis, together with conducting trials, CRISPR genome editing. I'm talking about humans. We can go on to non-humans in a minute. Yes, as you know, there's the first CRISPR babies caused all manner of scandal. This is reckless genetic experimentation with human lives, but all babies are genetic experiments, and if you consider it ethical to bring new life, new suffering in the world, I think at least one should be prepared to load the genetic dice in favor of your kids. And by even a handful of small genetic tweaks, it is possible to create babies with a high hedonic set point and a high pain threshold. Something like SCN9A, gene modulating pain sensitivity, or the Jo Cameron case recently. She's this 73-year-old retired Scottish school teacher, responsible vegan, pillar of the local community. She has two unusual mutations of the far and far out genes, which essentially means she's extremely high endocannabinoid levels. She's naturally extremely happy, cheerful, optimistic, anxiety-free. There are risks, and she came to the attention of doctors, medical researchers, because her pain threshold was so high that essentially she regarded childbirth as a mere tickle. I'm told by people who've experienced childbirth without anesthetics, it's rather more traumatic than that. And disdain for painkillers for what would otherwise be an extremely unpleasant medical procedure. Now, yeah, I mean, that's in terms of rewriting the human genome, that is going to take centuries. I can imagine all manner of missteps, pitfalls, you name it. But nonetheless, even now, it would be possible by offering pre-implantation genetic screening and counselling to, in a sense, reduce the burden of new suffering. In the case of older people, or existing people rather, biohacking, once again, there are all manner of pitfalls here. But essentially, I think we need a debate as to whether we want to ratchet up hedonic set points. I'm sometimes told I use jargon, but the hedonic treadmill, just in case anyone is wondering, this is the idea that each of us has some kind of average hedonic set point around which we tend to fluctuate in the course of a lifetime, and that, let's say, 6 months after either a terrible tragedy or some piece of wonderful good news, winning the lottery, most people will have returned to this baseline, which may be, by Darwinian standards of life, pretty good or pretty bad. But it's not saying that environmental contingencies are irrelevant, but it does say that essentially evolution designed us not to sit around counting our blessings, to be discontented a lot of the time, and that in spite of the tremendous material progress over past few centuries, nonetheless, most people on average aren't any more or less happy than our ancestors in the ancestral environment of adaptation. Yeah, I mean, we can talk about timelines. I know a lot of people mentally tend to switch off if they think it's not going to happen in their lifetime. Essentially, I think the number one priority right now is making sure that, yeah, if one is creating life, one isn't creating new unnecessary suffering. That's humans. With non-humans, I suspect our era could well be defined, at least by the lights of our grandchildren, by the death factories, factory farming, slaughterhouses, the horrific abuse of non-humans. I mean, a pig is as sentient and demonstrably as sapient as a toddler, and we behave towards non-humans in ways that would get the perpetrator locked up for life if the victim were a small child. And yeah, I mean, that's the low-hanging fruit. Essentially, get factory farms, slaughterhouses shut and outlawed, in practice, it's going to probably come in tandem with cultured meat alternatives. What used to be regarded as sci-fi cultured meat is about to hit the mainstream. I really do see that as morally urgent. Looking slightly further ahead, there's clearly a tremendous amount of suffering in nature. Wildlife, through most of our history, this, so far as people would worry about it at all, which most people don't, it would just seem, you know, a brute fact on the level of the second law of thermodynamics or something. But in practice, a combination of CRISPR genome editing and synthetic gene drives that cheat the laws of so-called laws of Mendelian inheritance mean that we can actually treat the level of suffering in nature as an adjustable parameter and spread benign versions of, for example, low pain genes, high hedonic set points throughout the living world. I mean, that's a bit counterintuitive, because when I wrote The Hedonistic Imperative, I'd imagined that we would be starting with large terrestrial vertebrates, but something like synthetic gene drives would actually make it easier and quicker actually to tackle something like marine invertebrates or small rodents, essentially driving benign versions of genes across entire populations. Something like gene drives are going to be used first to eliminate vector-borne disease like malaria that affects humans as well as non-humans. But eventually the whole biosphere is programmable. I mean, what would start to something like self-contained biospheres? It's not a matter of setting gung-ho PhDs at loose on the environment.
So much of the suffering in the natural environment in the animal kingdom seems to be due to predation. Animals eating other animals, the suffering that's entailed in that. But ending suffering wouldn't necessarily have to entail ending predation. For example, you could modify a gazelle to thoroughly enjoy the process of being torn apart and eaten by a lion. This would eliminate the suffering, but would not eliminate the predation. Do you see any desire to eliminate predation if the animals, for example, enjoyed that process?
Ah, this is the cow that likes to be eaten. In practice, the level of reprogramming there would be extraordinarily ambitious, given the point of aiming for low pain and elevated hedonic set points is that it's possible to retain the whole suite of adaptive behavioral responses, so that essentially, yeah, if you simply elevate hedonic set points, you enable living organisms still to respond to noxious stimuli. Whereas if you try to engineer a cow or a gazelle to enjoy being eaten, it's hard to see how the gazelle would be able to function outside some extremely contrived wildlife park.
So I can understand how that explanation works for the natural world and the natural environment. I can think of an example, though, perhaps with factory farming, which you brought up, which I agree is terrible and we should work to eliminate it. But I can imagine a future in which we have cows and chickens that live in a largely natural habitat that makes them happy and meets their needs, and then they are painlessly killed at the end of their life. And during their life, they experience joy and gradations of bliss, and then have it ended for the meat consumption of humans. These are animal lives that would not have existed if they were not born for the purpose of being eaten later. Do you see any ethical concerns with this, or how would you like to solve this issue?
I think in practice, going for cultured meat is a much more promising route. Whether it is growing human babies for the pot, what if they had a happy existence? Would this be ethical? Insofar as it's ethical for a human baby, I would say it's ethical for, let's say, a happy pig. But I think humans can't be trusted, and it's much better if we aim to uphold in law the sanctity of life, i.e. to aim at systematically helping sentient beings rather than harming them. And if we're thinking, how can we exploit and use them more humanely, this is potentially disastrous. So, yeah, I mean, sometimes I talk about high-tech Jainism. Jains, if you recall, in India, sweep the ground in front of them rather than inadvertently tread on an insect. Now, I'm personally a careless pedestrian and, as I said, a scientific rationalist. But, I think what is needed is a change in mentality, i.e. not thinking how we can exploit others with less cruelty and suffering, but how we can actively help others. In practice, I'm cynical, stroke realistic, pessimistic enough to think that any true kind of moral revolution, it's no good asking humans, consumers, to make any non-trivial personal sacrifice, which is why I think cultured meat is so important, development of cultured meat. Cultured meat is also a kind of stopgap for today's obligate carnivores. Many people, if they hear someone wants to reprogram predators or phase out predation, think, oh, this evil person wants to kill my cat, kind of thing. Whereas, catnip-laced cultured meat is the kind of workaround, temporary solution until we can actually reprogram today's obligate carnivores. I mean, personally, as I stress the personally, I wouldn't be sad if today's snakes, lions, tigers, and the other obligate carnivores were to be non-violently retired. But many people are absolutely aghast at this notion. And so, yeah, I wrote this piece, Reprogramming Predators, explaining how, in principle, at any rate, technically, one can use genome editing together with cross-species fertility regulation to essentially get rid of predation as it exists today.
So let's get back to a term that you've used a few times towards the beginning of this conversation, and that is negative utilitarianism. In much of your work, you seem to take this negative utilitarian approach of prioritizing the elimination of negative experiences over amplifying well-being. What was it about negative utilitarianism that drew you in?
Yeah, I mean, one thing one needs to be careful of is that however much, one thinks one is talking about the next few million or billion years, but in fact, one is describing one's own personal experience. And yeah, suffering, pain, low mood, thinking about it has loomed larger in my life than, let's say, happy experiences. And any of your listeners who are basically happy or optimistic are likely to have a very different conception of life on Earth as it exists today. Having said that, I don't think it's idiosyncratic that probably for most sentient beings, sadly, their lives are pretty nasty, brutish and short. And intuitively, at any rate, there will be a need to defend this. If someone is already happy and contented, there doesn't seem to be any inbuilt moral urgency to make them even more happy. I mean, I'm all in favor of it, but it's not morally urgent in the same way. Whereas if someone is suffering, or some sentient being is suffering, there's something about the very nature of suffering that it's self-intimatingly bad, which is not to say that most humans, let alone non-humans, are closet utilitarians. Nature has engineered things so that, at least from my perspective, I'm the center of the universe and my suffering and the suffering of my loved ones matters more than everyone else. But insofar as one does take the scientific world picture, view from nowhere, one realizes that the egocentric illusion is an illusion, that suffering is self-intimatingly bad for me, and therefore it's self-intimatingly bad for anyone, anywhere. And yeah, that's as I would see it, this asymmetry. But it's not necessary for anyone to buy into negative utilitarianism, suffering-focused ethics, or even Buddhism to buy into the abolitionist project, in that most secular and religious belief value systems attach some weight to minimizing suffering in the world. And so, yeah, I think one should be aiming to reach out, compromise and consensus, stress one isn't talking about forcing anyone to be happy or to be genetically engineered against their will. It's important not merely to delve into the purely technical issues, but also to explore the political, sociological angle.
You referenced Hobbes there, and for many living things, life is still nasty, brutish, and short. And perhaps because of a lot of your work with negative utilitarianism, it gets into the realm of antinatalism. Which is often understood as a position that views procreation as a negative, often because the act of bringing new life into the world is likely to condemn that life to some level of involuntary suffering. I'd love to explore this further. Would you self-describe as antinatalist, and what are your positions on this topic?
Yeah, I'm a so-called soft antinatalist, as distinct from a hard extinctionist antinatalist. I personally don't feel it is ethically justifiable to bring more pain and suffering into the world. I think personally it's akin to child abuse. However, such is the nature of selection pressure that hard antinatalism simply won't work, that most people have a deep inner need to reproduce, to have children. And rather than moralizing at people who are determined to have children, I think it is much more fruitful to focus on ensuring that the lives of future children are initially not nearly as bad as they are for so many people today, but eventually blissful lives. Essentially, I agree with David Benatar, and I know probably most of your audience won't agree, the kind of better never to have been, that I think Darwinian life is truly monstrous. It's unspeakable. But David Benatar's hard antinatalist solutions simply don't work. There is essentially going to be intense selection pressure against any predisposition not to have children. It won't work. By contrast, something like the abolitionist project, in principle at any rate, though it is a monumental, mind-boggling challenge, in principle at any rate, I think one can see how it's going to happen, in that we're on the brink of a reproductive revolution of designer babies, and sure, the first things that are going to go are the recognized genetic diseases. But before long, there is going to be intense and intensifying selection pressure against a predisposition to the nastier forms of experience that were adaptive in the ancestral environment of adaptation. So, I am an antinatalist. I wouldn't personally want to bring more pain and suffering into the world, but it's not my main focus. It's also worth stressing too that humans, in spite of the fact that we cause more pain and suffering than any species on Earth, we are the only species intellectually capable of reprogramming the biosphere to eradicate suffering altogether. So in that sense, it's important that we survive.
You're on record as saying that if there existed a button that would instantly and painlessly eradicate our physical reality and all that inhabit it, you would push that button. Now, this button does not exist, so all conversations on this topic are largely hypothetical and therefore happen at a bit of a distance. But let's at least make this somewhat more plausible by saying that our universe had a false vacuum and you discovered an action that would trigger vacuum decay and near instantaneously eliminate all life on Earth and physics as we know it. Would you, if given that opportunity, trigger vacuum decay?
Well, vacuum decay would indeed be instantaneous and involve no suffering. But personally, I would do so. I think a lot of people, particularly basically very happy people, find this unintelligible. But often I turn this that turns status quo bias on its head. Instead of imagining this button that extinguishes all life and existence, imagine there is another button, and you press that, and a type identical copy of our universe, or strictly our multiverse, is created with all its joys and happiness and beautiful, but all its unspeakable pain, suffering, you know, something like 850,000 people kill themselves each year, just unimaginable pain and suffering. Would you press a button to create a type identical copy of this world? And whether or not, on reflection, you would choose to do so, there doesn't seem to be anything abhorrent about refusing to create unimaginable suffering like this. And so essentially, yeah, I think that evolution has engineered us with status quo bias. It's not fruitful to, philosophers do these kind of things, but it's not fruitful to explore the what if, would you press the button, instead of world destruction. I think it's more fruitful, in fact, more desirable to enshrine in law something like the sanctity of life, because, yes, imagine if one went to the doctor not knowing whether the doctor might think that, your quality of life was so bad you were put out of your misery or something. Humans can't be trusted. So I think, though I don't literally believe in the sanctity of life, I think it's far better to uphold it, to be thinking of ways, to promote the well-being of all sentience rather than the kind of the fantastical what if. Strangely, instead of if one doesn't say one is negative utilitarian, one instead gives people the Ursula Le Guin fable, you know, the ones who walk away from Omelas, in which this a short story, inhabitants of the city of Omelas, this city of fabulous delights, everyone has an absolutely wonderful, fantastic time. But for unexplained reasons, the existence of this wonderful city of delights is dependent on the torment of a single child. Now, yeah, I mean, compared to all the wondrous super happiness, this suffering of the single child is, yeah, it's a mere pinprick in comparison. But a lot of people would walk away from Omelas, even though it's just a single instance of child abuse. And essentially, that's the insight I have, that no amount of wondrous delights justifies the horror. So yeah, I'd walk away from Omelas, but given there is no off switch, I think we should be focusing on building a better world for everyone. There's just one more point I would add here, that whereas classical utilitarians associated with the kind of the symmetry of pleasure and pain, negative utilitarians associated with essentially focusing on suffering. But if one is a classical utilitarian, in principle at any rate, one is morally obligated to press a button that unleashes a so-called utilitronium shockwave, where utilitronium is matter and energy optimized for pure bliss, and shockwave alludes to its velocity of propagation. And that if you think, and it sounds a quite kind of sensible thing to do, that shouldn't we be aiming to, you know, not really minimize suffering but maximize happiness? But nonetheless, classical utilitarianism, strictly applied, has maybe the seeds of the destruction of civilization too. So yeah, I mean, all value systems have counterintuitive implications. No one need take seriously my own personal views on negative utilitarianism to think it would be good to phase out the biology of involuntary suffering. I mean, that's just my own personal view.
Yeah, you brought up some very interesting thought experiments there. Just to quickly outline where I stand on these issues, I would not choose to trigger vacuum decay. I would push a button that would duplicate our existence and everything that entails. And if given the opportunity, I would not unleash a utilitronium shockwave. And I don't necessarily have any logical or rational justification for these choices. They are just my initial reactions based on my values and my desire for self-preservation. but these are fascinating topics to think about. And when
I'm interrupting you.
No, go ahead.
No, I was saying that back to the issue of practicalities, that's another reason distress information sensitive gradients. If we preserve essentially information sensitive gradients of well-being, it's possible to retain critical insight, social responsibility, intellectual progress, and it's not asking you to give up your cherished values and beliefs. This is really quite important, in that so many people, you know, we're social primates, have countless irreconcilable preferences, desires, and values, and it's logically impossible to reconcile them all. And certainly you, and perhaps many of your listeners, will not agree with my suffering focused ethics, but nonetheless, by focusing on ratcheting up hedonic set points, it's not necessary for anyone to give up what they most care about, unless one of the things they care about is preserving hedonic set points, which isn't very common.
When contemplating artificial general intelligence or artificial superintelligence, we often discuss the value alignment problem and the existential risk potential in AI. For example, if we task an AGI with eradicating cancer or eradicating suffering, it might determine that the best way to accomplish that goal would be to eradicate life. And in this way, the actions taken by the AGI might not be aligned with the values of the person creating the task. And in many ways, you seem to be what some might consider a human version of a poorly value-aligned AI. So I guess one way of phrasing my question is, are you an existential risk?
Well, I don't think anyone is currently planning to delegate management of the global ecosystem to philosophers. So I don't think so. Seriously. I mean, there are different conceptions of what superintelligence amounts to. Very, very crudely, and I stress this is a very crude typology, there are some conceptions of superintelligence that imagine essentially superintelligence as our biological descendants, genetically written, AI enhanced, but nonetheless our descendants, down the Neuralink route or something like that. And that is my scenario I find most credible, that essentially classical digital computers are zombies. They're not going to wake up and start investigating altered states of consciousness. There's an immense range of problems that are incomprehensible to digital zombies. And in that sense, and this is unusual for transhumanists, I'm, I suppose, a biological supremacist. That's one conception of superintelligence. The idea, as I said, that not complete fusion, but a partial fusion of sentient beings, sentient transhumans and posthumans, with unimaginable computer power at our disposal, to some extent integrated in our CNS. Then there is a second conception of superintelligence associated with Ray Kurzweil, essentially complete fusion of humans and our machines, possible mind uploading for technical reasons. I don't think mind uploading is feasible, that classical digital computers are not capable of phenomenal binding. They're going to become subjects of experience. So I'm personally skeptical there. But there's a third conception of post-human superintelligence that originated mathematician I.J. Good, associated with Eliezer Yudkowsky and Miri, and most recently Nick Bostrom in his magisterial book Superintelligence, the so-called intelligence explosion scenario, which combines Moore's law with this notion of recursively self-improving software-based AI, some kind of runaway intelligence explosion, and the behavior of this notional AGI might be inimical to human interests for various reasons. I don't think this is going to happen, but when one talks about post-human superintelligence, one needs to define one's terms. I've strayed rather from your original question. Am I a risk? No. Could someone who thought like me be a risk in future? Well, as I said, I strenuously urge, you know, sanctity of life. I'm upholding the sanctity of life in law, even the humblest creatures. I don't think humans can be trusted. Depending on your value system, someone like me might be a risk. But as I said, my own focus of my own work, and you might find it incongruous and a negative utilitarian, is actually the creation of life based on gradients of intelligent bliss. If you say something like Buddhism or suffering focused ethics, this doesn't conjure up someone focused on the creation of a civilization based on, let's say, plus 70 to a plus 100.
And you brought up Nick Bostrom there, and this is all extremely interesting to me because in 1998, you joined forces with him to form the World Transhumanist Association, which now exists as Humanity Plus. And Nick Bostrom, of course, is the founding director of the Future of Humanity Institute at Oxford University, which studies and explores existential risk. So I think it's very interesting that a negative utilitarian that would end physical reality if given the chance, such as yourself, would team up with someone focused on mitigating existential risk and found an organization. How did the two of you initially partner for that, and what was the goal?
Yes, you've picked up on a certain tension there. Essentially, back in 1997, a young postgrad at LSE and part-time stand-up comedian Nick Bostrom. He came across my work, The Hedonistic Imperative, and fired off a couple of incisive questions, and we met up and set up the World Transhumanist Association. For him, I think he was much more focused on this idea, a different motivational architecture based entirely on gradients of bliss. I mean, the problem of suffering doesn't loom as large for Nick as it does for me. But we set up the World Transhumanist Association with this idea, kind of broad, essentially some kind of umbrella for the different strands of what has come to be known as transhumanism. It's a very, very diverse movement, to put it mildly. Sometimes I like to talk of the three supers: super intelligence, super longevity, and super happiness. But that's very simplistic. But as you rightly detect, there is a certain irony in a negative utilitarian and someone focused on existential risk joining forces like that, shall we say. I mean, I chatted to Nick last year, Max Tegmark, Future of Life, and we were discussing the binding problem of all things, though it's more relevant to the issue of AI than you might imagine. But transhumanism is tremendously diverse, and you will get a dozen different definitions from people. But commitment in the transhumanist declaration to the well-being of all sentience is ultimately why I describe myself as a transhumanist. I think defeating death and aging are going to be wonderful, and post-human superintelligence will ensure life is probably sublime. But transhumanism means overcoming the horrors of Darwinian life and abolishing suffering.
So strictly speaking, the only thing that I know for sure is that I am having an experience. I am conscious. I could be a brain in a vat somewhere in a fictional reality in which I'm interacting with you now, in which you are a philosophical zombie and you do not have any subjective experience. But I make the assumption in my day-to-day life that the humans I'm interacting with are conscious people who are experiencing things, and I'd make the same assumptions with animals as well. But I wonder if we should extend that. For example, you said you had some doubts about whether the computers we have today could reach a level of consciousness or experience suffering, but with advanced computers, or perhaps with tissues and cell cultures or with plants or other things, should we make an assumption of consciousness? Because if we assume wrongly, we could be inadvertently causing levels of suffering that we cannot comprehend. Where should we treat these seemingly inanimate objects that may or may not be on the line between conscious and unconscious?
Yes, though it might seem remote from anything like the abolitionist project, it's vital we get our theory of mind and consciousness right for fear of doing something extremely stupid. I personally take panpsychism, or more strictly, non-materialist physicalism seriously as a possible solution to the hard problem of consciousness. But even if one thinks, as I incline to, it's certainly a perspective I take seriously, that consciousness is fundamental to the world, that quantum field theory describes fields of sentience rather than insentience. Nonetheless, this isn't the same as animism. One needs to explain how to solve the binding problem. Why is it that even though, an example, 320 million American skull-bound minds, however they interact, intercommunicate, there isn't a continental subject of experience, or 200 million odd nerve cells, the brain and the gut, the enteric nervous system, yet to the best of our knowledge, the brain and the gut is not a person. How is it that apparently 86 billion odd discrete membrane-bound nerve cells come together when you're asleep or dreaming into a unified subject of experience? I mean, this is the binding problem. And in the case of a classical digital computer, imagine replacing the ones and zeros of a classical Turing machine, or perhaps a tape as Turing originally envisaged, with notional sort of discrete micro pixels of experience. However fast you run the program, however sophisticated the software, all you've got is a micro experiential zombie. Just patterns of Jamesian mind dust. And binding seems to be classically impossible. The binding problem is the reason, one of the reasons, primary reasons why David Chalmers is inclined to dualism. Now, I'm not a dualist, I'm a monistic physicalist, but here we go into the realm of quantum mind and stuff that, well, would take a podcast of its own. I don't think our minds are classical phenomena. I think you and your phenomenal world simulation is what a quantum mind feels like from the inside. And for technical reasons, yes, I don't think classical digital computers are ever going to wake up and become subjects of experience. And so I would avoid treading on a worm, but I would happily eat a carrot encased in cellulose cell walls, or kick a silicon robot.
One thing that I've always found interesting is the idea of Robert Nozick's experience machine, or pleasure machine. For now, having to choose between experiencing physical reality or artificially entering a state of continued complete euphoria is largely fictional. But as we understand more and more about neurochemistry and create more and more realistic virtual and augmented reality experiences, this decision could soon become one that we all have to make. For me, I'd rather face the ups and downs of physical reality and interacting with other humans than experiencing some fictional utopia. What are your thoughts on Nozick's experience machine?
Personally, if I didn't think I could do any useful good in this world, I would happily step into an experience machine. But a lot of people wouldn't. Though strangely, there's the so-called inverse experience machine argument, such that a lot of people, if they were, you know, ask them if you were to learn that your entire life was a lie, that you were essentially living in an experience machine, would you want to know? Would you prefer the red pill or the blue pill? Most people allegedly, according to one study, would prefer the status quo. But stepping back a bit, I mean, one of the advantages of hedonic recalibration, of ratcheting up hedonic set points initially to today's existing hedonic outliers, but eventually to much higher, is that we don't need to choose between the red pill and the blue pill. We don't need to choose whether to enter an experience machine or live in what passes as the real world, pretending we're naive realists, which I think is untenable. And that though in some ways I think that more and more people are going to be spending more and more of their lives in immersive VR, I don't think immersive VR quasi experience machines, because they don't recalibrate the hedonic treadmill, they're not actually definitively going to solve the problem of suffering. Moreover, the nature of selection pressure means that I don't think experience machines or immersive VR are ever going to supersede life in basement reality. But whereas today, basement reality is pretty ghastly, if we reprogram ourselves, it can be paradise.
So if you could, how would you rate your pain tolerance in general demeanor? I've heard you say a few times that you'd rather sign away the keys to your flat than experience 10 seconds of torture. And you seem to react with a bit of shock when others say that they wouldn't. And honestly, to me, it seems a bit surprising that anyone would prefer to give up their home rather than experience 10 seconds of torture. So I wonder if perhaps your perception to these negative feelings and suffering is greater than that of other people.
It's possible, but, you know, from observation going to the dentist or so, I wouldn't say that I'm unusually sensitive to pain. It's just that the nature of severe torture, I mean, one can say the word torture and it sounds a bit like bad breath, but it really is quite unspeakable, unspeakably vile. I mean, I have a friend with an exceptionally high pain threshold, and he regards this as incomprehensible. But describing this as as a fact of my psychology, this is it. One could spend time now dwelling on just how appalling mental and physical pain and suffering could be. In that sense, it's important to locate the discussion, so to convey the kind of the moral seriousness of the project. But equally, if people spend too much time just thinking about suffering and just how awful it is and how much of it is, it could induce a kind of fatalism, learned helplessness, behavioral despair, which is not going to help anyone.
So I am totally in favor of giving other humans the option to augment themselves or those they are charged with taking care of, such as their future offspring or their children, with augmenting them to not experience pain and suffering. I get a little bit more hesitant when it comes to augmenting the natural world and animals, because you intrinsically at that point cannot receive consent. So I wonder if a way around this process would be to first engage in animal uplift, raise the intelligence of these creatures, which may inherently, as you've speculated before, also increase their compassion and empathy, and then leave it up to the animals to decide what they want to do with themselves. What do you think about this approach?
Generally, I would be in favor of uplift. There are tricky issues of the nature of identity and species essentialism here. Some bioconservative critics, even the idea of genetically tweaking a lion so the lion doesn't prey and terrorize gazelles and zebras, claims that it's not a true lion anymore. In terms of the issue of consent, essentially I would see non-human animals as akin to small children. And sometimes one just has to act in the, with small children. The small child does not realize why he or she needs a nasty needle administering the painkiller, the antibiotics, anesthesia. There is this degree of implied consent in that no sentient being wants to be harmed. Okay, that's a sweeping statement. There are one or two complications that spring to mind, but nonetheless, with a handful of exceptions, essentially sentient beings don't want to starve. They don't want to see their offspring traumatized or predated. Essentially, there's implied consent. And yeah, creating a world in which no sentient beings are harmed involves, I mean, yeah, humans can practice family planning, whereas non-human animals can't practice cross-species fertility regulation via immunocontraception. So in that sense, one has to be paternalist eventually.
What are your thoughts on free will?
Free will? Ultimately, I don't believe in free will. All that exists is the continuous, linear, unitary, and deterministic evolution of the universal Schrödinger equation, as a physicist might say. But it's in the light of what we've been discussing, it's really important to stress, I think, that what we're talking about is consent, of not forcing anyone to suffer against their will. And regardless of your position, the metaphysics of free will, shall we say, nonetheless, in the ordinary familiar sense, I don't think people should be forced to be happy, forced to have their hedonic set point elevated. Essentially, it should be a matter of personal choice. Right now, of course, most people have no choice at all. That suffering is involuntary for the most part.
I think I would agree with everything you said there in that answer. So one last thing, I guess, is what is next for you? Are there any talks or conferences coming up or papers that you're working on? Or what are you thinking about now?
Essentially, I'm a writer. I'm not a doer, an organizer, a mover and shaker. The transhumanist movement is developing. The influence of transhumanist ideas greatly exceeds the number of self-avowed transhumanists. Essentially, my role in the great scheme of things is inevitably extremely tiny, but as long as I feel cognitively competent to do so, yeah, essentially I intend to continue articulating this particular conception of transhumanism, abolitionist project, writing, but essentially, yeah, flying the flag for the biohappiness revolution.
Well, this was a conversation that I've been looking forward to for a while. I've long wanted to get you on the podcast to discuss these topics because I think they are immensely interesting. I look forward to continuing to explore them. And I would suggest that anyone in the audience read your works and continue the conversations and thoughts themselves. Thank you again for joining me on the podcast.
Ryan, it's been a pleasure. Look forward to our next chat.
Hey, everyone. Ryan O'Shea again. And thanks for listening to my interview with David Pierce. Remember to check out the show notes and more at futuregrind.org. Make sure to subscribe, leave a review, and you can also like, comment, and share to spread the word. We also need your help to keep this podcast running. You can donate at futuregrind.org/support or make a purchase at futuregrind.org/store. Till next time, this is Future Grind.